This is an ABC podcast.
The life and career of Fifa Riccobono is one of those classic migrant success stories. Fifa came to Australia as a small girl with her family from Sicily. She joined a company on the bottom rung, and she travelled all the way to the top as the company became a giant international enterprise and a major Australian cultural institution. The company was Albert's Music, and Fifa, along with those other migrant kids, Harry Vander and George Young, helped transform AC/DC into one of the biggest bands in the world. And Vander and Young also produced songs for John Paul Young, The Angels and Rose Tattoo. Fifa started out at Albert's as a secretary, and she rose to become the first female label chief in Australian music history. And along the way, she became known as the godmother of Australian music. Hi, Fifa.
Hello, Richard. That was quite an intro.
You come from Sicily. That's where you were born. Tell me about this little town where you were born, Fifa.
Oh, I love the fact that I come from Sicily. I was born in a little town called Balestrate, which is the last town in the province of Palermo, and it's a seaside town. I was born there. I was in Sicily to the age of four. My brother was 2.5 years older than me, and my parents had a tiny little, well, I guess it was just a little rented cottage that was like two rooms, but it was ours and we loved it and we loved being there. All my family was there. My dad had three sisters. My mum had three brothers. They were all married with kids. So I had lots of family around me, lots of cousins, grandparents and great-grandparents. And it was a very, very family, villagey town that was just very poor, but only poor as far as money went, but very rich in love and nurturing.
I've got a real thing for Sicily, Fifa. It has the most amazing history. Like, every empire has been through that place, from the Phoenicians, the Romans, the Greeks, the Arabs, the United States Army's been through there. Can you see all that as you walk around the island?
Oh, it is the most spectacular island. I mean, I just forget how beautiful it is. Every time I go back, I'm just in awe. It's even, you know, better than the last time I saw it, and I go there regularly. It has got a touch of everything. It's got the Moors have left things there, the Greeks, the Romans, the Vikings. We've got amphitheatres that are just stunning. We've got fortresses, you know, from the 11th century. We've got the best mosaics in the world. It's stunning. And if you go through, you can see all the different cultures there. You can see it in the food, you can see it in the clothing, you can see it in everything. It's very rich and colourful.
Were you born in your parents' house?
My brother and I were both born at home. Everyone was born at home back in those days. I don't think we even had a doctor in the town. I think we did have a doctor, but that was about it. There wasn't a hospital or a clinic or anything like that. There was nothing nearby. Everybody had babies at home.
Where had your mum been raised?
My mum was raised in the same town, as was my dad. My mum was orphaned. She lost her mum at the age of two and her dad at the age of six. So she moved in with her grandmother, and she actually went to school only for a couple of years. They took her out of school when she was about eight because they were very poor. I mean, everyone was as poor as church mice back then. She just basically lived with her grandparents, and she adored her grandmother. And at the age of 12, her grandmother passed away, so then she moved over to an uncle's place. It was her father's brother. She moved in with them, and they had five children, and she stayed there until she was 16, and then she moved in with her grandmother on her mother's side, and she stayed there till she was married. She moved around a lot, but didn't have a place to call her own really until she married my dad.
Even though there wasn't much money in those days, did you eat well in the old country as a family?
Oh, well, we never went without food. Never went without food. And we didn't eat richly, but we ate well. Meat was not, you know, really on the menu, but pasta, we lived on pasta, obviously, and fresh bread and oils and, you know, fresh vegetables, loads of fresh vegetables. All the families had a little allotment, you know, in the country, where a little property where they grew, you know, their fruit and vegetables. That was what they did. They just tended the fields and came home with food. Every day they'd go out with their donkeys or mules and come back with food. It was all our own produce. I mean, we haven't seen a tin can, I don't think, ever during my time in Italy at all until I went back 20 years later.
How were household chickens in those days?
I have a fabulous story about household chickens, and it's my mum's two aunts, my two great aunts. There are 2 years difference between them, and the two of them would fight like cat and dog all the time. One of them was considered herself to be incredibly intelligent, and the other one was more the housewife. Even though one was married and the other one was single, the single one lived in the same house and did all the cooking. And they had chickens on the terrace. The terrace was at the top, and that's where you hung your clothes and you kept your, if you had chickens, that's where you kept your chickens. And my aunt this particular time had cooked a meal, and her sister, the younger one, and the older sister turned around and she said, "What have you put in the meal?" And she said, "Well, just eat it, will you?" And she said, no, she said, "There's eggs there." And she said, "Yes, there's eggs there." And she said, "Well, where did you get the eggs?" And she said, "Look, just eat it. It's fine." She said, no. She said, "I went up this morning." She said, "The chickens hadn't laid any eggs." She said, "I'm not eating eggs that belong to somebody else's chickens." She said, "I don't know what they're fed their chickens, but I'm certainly not going to eat eggs that come from somewhere else." And her sister was just like beside herself and just saying, "For God's sake," she wouldn't eat it. She didn't touch food. She didn't know where those eggs came from. She's about to say, many years later, I told my aunt, the one that complained, I told her that we bought our eggs from the supermarket. She was horrified, absolutely horrified. She said, "So you don't know whose chickens they are?" And I said, wouldn't have a clue.
Well, I love stories like that because they make me rethink of what poverty actually is. Because if your parents are living in terrible, dire poverty but surrounded by magnificent architecture and eating good, fresh, healthy food and eating eggs from their own chickens, I don't know. Is that poverty? What is that? I don't know what that is.
Well, we never saw it as poverty because, I mean, we were, as kids, we were well loved and you know, we loved being, you know, with each other, and that's what it was all about back then. It was all family. I mean, you always had stacks of kids. Everyone knew everyone, and everyone comfortably walked around. The kids could go from one grandparent to another grandparent 5 blocks away and nobody would think twice about it. It was all family.
So why did your parents feel they needed to leave?
Well, I don't think that anyone ever sat down and said, "Oh, look, I think we need to move somewhere else." It's just my dad had worked for a company that made masala, which is a very famous masala made in Sicily. And the owner had been kidnapped and ransom had been requested. And to pay the ransom to get him back, the company went under. So my dad had worked there for 17 years and he'd never done anything else other than that. But he was prepared, you know, he was married and had 2 kids and he was prepared to do anything because he had to support his family. There's nobody else that was going to support them. Women didn't work back then. So he put his hand to everything. He did bricklaying. He even went out fishing. And I mean, he was a terrible fisherman. I mean, he hated the sea because he always got seasick and he'd throw up the entire time he was out. But he gave it a shot. It came a time where there was just no work at all. And 2 of my mum's cousins had come out to Australia and said to him, you know, they wrote back and said, "Look, there's a chance for you to come out here. You can work and earn some money." So they saved what little money they had so my dad could come over. And that's what he did. He came over in the early 50s and joined my uncles or my cousins. And he started working here. And his intention was to come out here, work for a year or two, you know, make some money and go back to Italy. And that's what the plan was. But once he got here, and it wasn't that easy, but he did have work and he was always grateful to have work. So he wrote to my mum and he said, "Look, there's no point in me coming back there because I'm coming back to nothing. I won't be able to get a job because nobody was working. It was still very, very bad in Sicily." He said, "I think it's better if you come out here," because at this stage they'd been separated for 2 years and it was a long time to be away from us and from mum. So, you know, he worked for the next 6 months just to get enough money to pay for our trips out here and we all came out to Australia.
So that meant you and the family then had to come and join your dad in Australia. What do you remember about that huge ocean voyage to the other side of the world, Fifa?
Oh, it's very vague, but the things that stick out in my mind is there was a lot of confusion when we were actually going to the boat. So I think some of our family came to see us off. So there was a lot of Italian hysteria or Sicilian hysteria going around. And we finally got on the boat, the ship left, and we went through Port Said, through Aden, and we stopped in Calcutta. And all I can remember is there were amazing smells, not bad smells, but just different smells. It was just exciting, really exciting, because there were people, you know, coloured people who we hadn't seen before. We'd never been out of our hometown, for goodness sake, hadn't been more than like six streets away from each other the entire time. And there was colour. I can remember oranges and blues and, you know, really bright, bright colours and a lot of confusion. It was very much what you'd expect a bazaar to be, but that's what I have in my mind. That's what I have in my mind. And the ship itself was that was pretty traumatic, because we were uprooted from a little tiny little cottage, and we on a boat. It was an English boat, so it was in English speaking, and nobody spoke Italian, and we didn't speak English. So my mum got seasick from the minute she stepped on the boat, and she was in bed for 3 weeks. Almost the entire trip, she was in bed. You know, she was seasick, so we would go to the dining room by herself. And I wasn't used to the smells of English food, and the very first time we went into the dining room, I threw up in the corridor, and I could remember that clearly and thinking, you know, they were going to throw me off the ship because I'd made a mess on their carpet, but they didn't. And I gradually got used to the smells and the taste. But the most I would have would be bread, and I actually was introduced to butter because we didn't use butter. And to this day, my brother won't touch butter. He thought it was the most revolting thing he'd ever tasted. And I went the opposite. I rather liked the taste of it. And the first words that I learnt was butter. And there was a lady who used to give me a little lolly every – she sat beside us at the table, and they were Morella jujubes. And I could say Morella jujubes, and I could say butter. And they were my first more or less English words that I learnt.
The ship would have gone down past Frio, then down up down to Melbourne. And then up to Sydney. What was it like to see your dad, having not seen him for more than 2 years?
It was horrible. I was really excited. You know, my mother kept, you know, building us up. You know, Dad was coming, and we were all excited. And all of a sudden, this man came up to us. And I think my recollection of my dad had been that my dad didn't have a moustache before he left, but he actually had a moustache when he came to meet us on the boat. And so it was like this strange man was coming up and putting his arm around my mum and around me and my brother, and I was pushing him away, and I'm going, no, no, don't want. And it was terrible. I wouldn't go anywhere near him, and it broke his heart. When I think about it now, it's horrible, but it broke his heart. I just didn't want him anywhere near us, and it took a couple of days to sort of settle down. And I was only four. And I hadn't seen him for over 2.5 years, so it was a big adjustment.
So where did he take you once you got into Sydney?
Oh, he had found there was a family that owned a house in Abbotsford. It was a big sort of Federation-style home, but Dad rented a room that also had a little alcove, and so that we could have two beds, you know, lying not alongside each other, but foot to head for my brother and myself. And then there was a double bed for where my parents slept. And it was one house, five families, one kitchen. Five families, one kitchen, one outside toilet, and one bathroom. Well, when I say a bathroom, well, one bath. Very, very... very difficult times.
That's just blowing my mind, Fifa. How did everyone cook?
Oh, my mother always told stories that used to make me laugh. She said she'd be at the front door of the house, and she wouldn't even take a coat off. She'd just run to the bedroom, grab a pot, because she kept everything in the bedroom, and go and put it straight away on top of one of the burners on the stove so that she could reserve that. And then she would get the food out to start cooking. But everybody would cook around the same time. There's only four burners, five families, and big families. I mean, the people that owned it had a daughter, so there was three of them. There were four of us. There were two married couples and two single men. So everybody would come in around, finish work around the same time, and everybody would have the same intention of sitting down to eat. So you'd have to wait till someone finished cooking before you could put your food on. And there was only one table, and the thing that you'd hear all the time was, could you make a bit more room, please? Could you move up a little bit more? And you'd almost be sitting there at the end with the plate in your lap, because the table was so small and there were just so many people. But that's all we had. That's all we could do.
Bloody hell, it sounds like the Soviet Union rather than Sydney in those days. And how quickly did your mum find a job? Was it easy for her?
It wasn't easy, but nothing was impossible for my mother, although it wasn't an easy thing. But she, within a week that she was in Australia, within a week in Sydney, she had a job. And my dad was working, so mum had managed to find a nearby neighbour who would look after me and my brother before school and after school. And I was only four, and they put me in school. And, you know, my brother went and I went to the same school, but the boys were on one side and the girls were on the other side. So there were two schools separated by a gate. So at four, I was literally, after a week in Australia, you know, I was literally taken to school and plonked in a school that I didn't speak a word of English. I knew nobody, and it was pretty frightening. But, you know, there was no option. It's not as if you had something else that you could do. That's the only thing that was the only option. My mum went to work, my dad went to work, and that's where we went. We went to school.
Was there anyone to help you through that hard, harsh initiation into Australian life and school, Fifa?
School was really very daunting for me, to go into a school and sit in a class and have no idea what anyone was talking about. And then we'd have these breaks. We'd have little break in the morning and a break at lunchtime, and everybody would race outside as I would follow. But everyone played, everyone knew each other and everyone got together, but I didn't, because I knew nobody. I couldn't speak English. Nobody could speak to me. So I'd sort of just sit by a tree and sit by myself. And one of the nuns that took my class, she was just so wonderful and she was so compassionate. And she would just come and get me, and she'd take me into the classroom while everybody else was out at lunch, and she'd sit me on her lap and she would show me the alphabet and read the alphabet to me. And I'd sit there and I felt so comfortable with her that she sort of became my surrogate mother at school. And I would sit on her lap every day and I'd play. She used to have rosary beads wrapped around her waist, as the nuns used to in the old formal habits. And I would sit there and I'd be holding her rosary beads, playing with the rosary beads as we'd be doing saying the ABC. And then she taught, within the first year that I was at school, she taught me my alphabet and she taught me how to read, and I could start to speak. And I was there for just on 18 months. And then we had to move, and my parents, we just couldn't live in the house anymore. We were just dying there. It was just not working for anybody. And Mum had said, look, even if we've just got enough of a deposit for a tent, as long as it's our tent and nobody can tell us what to do with it, we're going to move into a tent. But they did get a deposit between the two of them over 18 months. And when I say a deposit, it was so minuscule, but it was enough to get us out of there and into our own place. And we bought the tiniest house in Leichhardt. And I say tiny because I've been back to see it and I can't believe that I thought it was a mansion when we lived there. It's like a shoebox. It's the size of a shoebox.
It must have looked like a palace to you then, though, having moved from a room in Abbotsford.
Oh, we thought it was amazing. You know, we thought, we've got a house, we own a house. And the house comprised of one lounge room that was probably 2.5 metres by 3.5 metres. That was huge, huge. The bedroom, there was one bedroom. My parents had that. And then there was an alcove, which I had. And then there was a lean-to, which was a bathroom, a kitchen. And the toilet was the usual toilet right at the very end of the backyard, right up the back. And we thought that was fabulous. My brother slept in the lounge room because we didn't have another bedroom. And so, you know, if we had guests, he didn't go to bed until everyone left. And we thought that was fabulous. And we had every kid in the street would come down to our place. They weren't familiar with Italians. We were the first Italians, one of the first Italians in Leichhardt, to be quite honest. And we used to have spaghetti. We used to have spaghetti on a Sunday, and kids used to come in just to watch us eat it. They thought that was terrific. And in the end, we used to have quite a few that would come in and have Sunday lunch just so that they could sit there and slurp spaghetti with us.
I don't know if you've ever seen the classic Australian movie called They're a Weird Mob from the 1960s,
sort
of follow the adventures of an Italian migrant as he makes his way amongst a strange and exotic people known as Australians. And there's a scene where he gets to work and he's digging ditches or something, but he's working furiously hard in the hot sun, and his Australian co-workers come up to him, tell him to tone it down, and because he's making them look bad, and you know, you should take more time for a smoko and for lunch. Was that your dad?
dad?
Oh, do you know, I reckon they got that from my dad, because that's exactly what happened to my dad when he was working. He worked with the council and various jobs that he had, where he had been told to slow down because he was showing them up. And he couldn't believe it. I swear that scene they've taken from my dad. And there was another thing that they used to happen to my dad. I mean, my dad was so friendly, and he was like the Pied Piper. Kids adored him. Everybody loved my dad. He was loud. He sang. He whistled. You could always tell when he was around. And he used to finish work. And the first time that he finished work, this is when we were living at Leichhardt, they were taking him to the pub for a drink. And he sort of thought, you know, being social, he'd go up to the pub and have a drink. So he had his first drink and said goodbye to everyone because he was going home to his family. I mean, the kids were home and he wanted to be there when my brother and I came back home from school. And they've gone, oh, no, 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 it's not done like that. And Dad was like a little bit unsure of what was going on. And it was like, no, you have to have a shout. And Dad realised then that it was, you know, it wasn't one drink. You didn't go up for one drink. You went up for a round of drinks. So if there were six of you, you had six drinks. So he wasn't a big drinker, and he really did. I mean, he would have a beer very happily, but, you know, six were totally out of the question. So the next time they went for a drink, he had the first shout so he could get out of the pub, you know, without people feeling that he was trying to, you know, miss out on his round. And he used to come back and he used to say, I can't believe it, they're all at the pub. Whereas he just expected they would go home to their families. It was very different, you know, in those days. And the pubs used to close at 6, so everyone would go in there and just drink, you know, as much as they possibly could before 6 so that they could get the last round in before the pub closed. But he wasn't a drinker, and it wasn't his lifestyle.
How about for you as a kid? What do you remember of day-to-day life as a knockabout kid growing up in Leichhardt, FIFA?
We loved Leichhardt. We loved it. In our street, we had quite a few kids. So before and after school, we always got together, and weekends, we always got together. We didn't have very much. Nobody did, but one of the boys up the top of the street, Kenny, had a bike, so we used to all have a go on his bike. And Wendy used to have a scooter, so we'd have a go on Wendy's scooter, and then someone else would have some dolls and would play with those. But everyone was always in our backyard because my parents were so easygoing, you know, and kids were just quite a normal thing in our background. So we'd have a table, this huge table at the back, right at the back, that was a table that we didn't use and would be in the house, and Dad just put it up against the back fence. Well, that became our playground. You know, we would get on that table and climb over the fence, climb up trees from it, you know, sit under it. We just made, you know, so much fun for ourselves, and it was so easy, and everybody knew everyone. Everyone would walk out, you'd go up to the shop. We had a beautiful old lady that lived in our street, Hilda. She had a, you know, bad polio when she was growing up. She was very crooked and had a terrible limp, but just the most beautiful woman. She loved animals. I don't think she liked people very much. She loved dogs. She loved cats, she loved birds, and she loved children. And she was the first one in our street to get a television. And we just loved Hilda because she would open the door to all of us, and she would have 10 kids in there on a Saturday and Sunday just watching commercials because there was nothing much on television. But the fact that we were watching a television, you know, we thought that was amazing. And then if she asked you to go to the shop, she'd always give you a sixpence. So everyone always wanted to do Hilda's shopping so we could get a sixpence. And she was a really generous, generous soul. That's the sort of childhood I had. And when I think of her, you know, I just get a smile on my face because she was so good to us.
FIFA, I think that nun maybe saw something in you, saw you were a bright kid, and you clearly did really well at high school. So why did you want to leave school at quite an early age?
Oh, I hated it. I hated school. I was doing well. I did quite well. I think there's no question that I wouldn't have done well at school had I not had that nun in the first place. She was the one that really enhanced my school years. I mean, to be able to speak English was the downfall of most new Australians that were coming out at that time. So she just gave me that real quick start in speaking. But I just sort of fallen between the cracks. You know, when I got to 14, I was just finding it hard to be, you know, I was neither Australian or Italian, and I was trying to find myself, and nobody understood me, and life was difficult. And I thought, you know, I need to get out on my own. I wasn't coping with growing up in the school environment. I wanted to leave, and I was pretty hard-headed, you know. And my parents, my mum said, no, no, you're going. She said, I never had the opportunity to go to school, but you're going. And she said, if I have to work forever to get you through university, that's what I'll do. Well, I just went into the education department in the city and I filled out an exemption form, forged my parents' signature on it, and said, you know, I had to leave school because my parents needed my help at home because we owned a shop at the time. All lies, absolute lies, because my mother had never wanted me to give up school to go to work, ever. I did that on the Thursday and I went looking for jobs on the Friday and I got 3 jobs lined up for the following Monday and I had to decide which job I wanted. But more importantly, I had to tell my parents I'd left school. I'd already given the school notice and everything. I hadn't told my parents. And on the Friday, I told my mum that I'd left school and she was horrified, absolutely horrified. And my dad was just, I think he just wanted to tear my head off, but he didn't. And the two, and I just said to him, I said, it's too late, it's done, I've left school and I've got a job and I'm starting on Monday. I went and started work as a filing clerk and I'd only been there for a nanosecond and realised that, oh, I'd probably made the biggest mistake of my life. This is not what I was going to want to do for the rest of my life.
Podcast, broadcast and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So how did you end up joining the seething, dangerous world of rock and roll, FIFA?
Well, my mother would probably, well, she didn't regret it at all, but she was the one that found an ad in the paper because we owned a shop and we sold newspapers. So she used to go through the paper all the time looking for things and I was looking for secretarial work or, in my mind, court reporter. And I had finished business college. I was going to take 2 weeks off and then I was going to look for a job. And I'd gone down. My dad used to work for the council and he'd do landscaping and gardening down at Botany and he was down at the Botany Pool. And it was a day that Dawn Fraser was actually training down there. She was training other swimmers. And he said, do you want to come down? You know, she's down there. You know, you might like to see her and that. And she was really, you know, a celebrity back in those years. And so I'd gone down there. And because my dad worked there regularly and in typical fashion, I mean, he knew everybody. Everybody knew him. So mum knew if she needed to contact him that she could call him down there. And she called him at the pool and said, you know, that she wanted to talk to me. And she told me there was this ad she read in the paper and it was to meet the stars and they wanted someone in my age range and they wanted someone with my qualifications and everything. And she said, you should go to it. And I was just really debating whether I should do it or not because I'd just been swimming. I had really long hair. My hair was soaking wet. And she said, just go, just give it a shot. And so got on the bus from Botany and went into the city and I went to Adams and Associates. It was that we're advertising it and they made me do a test there. I took a test there and they said, well, look, we'll send you around, but there's quite a lot of girls there already and you're the last one. And so they actually called the company first and said, you know, will you take one more? And they said yes. And so I went round and I really was the last one and it was a Friday and I had the last interview and the guy took a liking to me, he must have, because he said, can you start work on Monday? And this was such a thorn in my side because I'd said I would take 2 weeks off. I've been at college. I want to have 2 weeks off. And he said, will you start on Monday? And I thought, yeah, okay, I'll start on Monday. And I thought, damn. And I went home and I said, well, I've got the job. And that was Albert's and that was the beginning of my career at Albert's.
Do you remember the first day at work there?
Not really the first day, but my first recollections of being there is that I had an office. Well, I didn't have an office. Outside my boss's office, there was a little corner and I had a desk there and my typewriter. And there was a tiny little counter and that's where we sold our sheet music from. And All I remember is that I was sitting out the front of a man's office and he had a piano in that office and he played music all day. And he was getting paid to play music, which was fantastic. I thought was incredible. But I was just overwhelmed, the fact that it was a music company. I was overwhelmed by that because it wasn't where my thinking had been at all. I was in awe. And it was a very, very sort of old-fashioned company. It was a very old-worldy company. And I was just trying to fit in. I wanted more than anything, just fit in. And, you know, I was in awe. But Henry Adler, who was my boss, my immediate boss, he was a real hard taskmaster, but he was so good to me in trying to teach me as much as he could. And I'll be forever grateful to him for it.
How then did Albert's Music, you know, Ted Albert being the founder there, how did they transition from being this lovely oldie worldy music publishing sheet music company into being this rock and roll empire, FIFA?
Well, Ted was actually, it was Ted's great-grandfather that was the founder, and Ted came into the company in 64, in the early 60s, and he had wanted to start something that was more contemporary. They were known for their sheet music back then and their boomerang songsters, and they sold harmonicas. If you remember, they sold the boomerang harmonicas, which is a big thing, and they also had the Chef College of Music. And what Ted wanted to do was, Alberts were a big publishing company, and they had always bought music in from overseas. They had, you know, represented, they became sub-publishers for all the great writers in America and in the UK, and they represented a wealth of wonderful old standards, beautiful, beautiful music that I was lucky enough to get to know because of Henry Adler. And what Ted wanted to do was, he actually wanted to create our own catalogue so that we could sell our catalogue overseas, as opposed to being the sub-publisher, being the publisher. And what he wanted to do was, he wanted to start signing writers and artists so that we would have a catalogue of songs. And that's what he started doing in the 60s, early 60s, around 64 when he came in. How lucky can you be, or is it luck? I mean, he was a visionary, and he could see talent. And his first two signings were, he signed Billy Thorpe and the Aztecs, and he signed the Easy Beats. And I came into the picture just after the Easy Beats had gone to England. So Billy Thorpe had been to our school when I was 12, and I just used to think, you know, how amazing it was. But I loved the Easy Beats, and I never got to see them. I was too young to go to see them anywhere. So when I ended up working at Albert's, I knew that Albert's, they were on the Albert label, but I didn't get to meet them because they had disbanded while they were in England. When they came back, they disbanded. So I never got to see the Easy Beats, but never did I in a million years think that I'd be, you know, working with George and Harry one day. They signed to Albert's as writers and as musicians in the Easy Beats, but, you know, further down the line, then they became partners with Ted and started Albert Productions. And that's where all the signings came in, and where they signed. This is where the rock and roll started. You know, in signing the Easy Beats and Billy Thorpe, that was the beginning, but then there was a big hiatus, and then George and Harry picked up on that when they came back in the 70s.
So that's when it became a hit factory, signing Stevie Wright, who's the former singer of the Easy Beats, and launching his solo career, AC/DC with the younger brothers of George Young, Malcolm and Angus, then down the road, the Angels and Rose Tattoo. These were golden years for the Australian rock music scene. These were amazing. Did it feel like that at the time? Did you feel like you had a kind of a rocket underneath you as this was all happening?
Well, we were blinkered. We never looked at anybody else. We were just looking at our path. George and Harry, they were just focused on what they want to do, and Ted was focused on where he wanted to take the company. And when you've got talented people like George and Harry with you, you're quite confident in their ability, so you let them get on with what they do best. And what they did best was they were great producers, they were great musicians, and they were great writers, so they could identify that in others. And, you know, when they brought someone to the stable, it was because they felt confident, and Ted had confidence in their ability. And so even though when you look at bands like Rose Tattoo, who were completely the opposite of what Alberts had been used to, took it on board, you know, he said, whatever it is you do, make sure you do it the best you can. And they were a great rock outfit, but they scared the living daylights out of people, you know. the tattooed men, I mean, you had this real heavy rock and roll band with Angry at the front and filed peak teeth in the front and tattoos from his neck down. He was scary. He was scarier than the other guys who were like 6 foot and tattooed. But he was so entertaining. He was such an entertaining guy. But like going back to George and Harry, they signed William Shakespeare. Why did they sign William? Because he had a unique voice and they had so many songs that they needed a particular type of singer to sing. So we signed William Shakespeare. They had a stable of songs. I mean, they had so many songs that they'd written that they were looking for a performer. John Paul Young perfectly, you know, fit the bill. They had songs that, rock songs, Stevie Wright. They signed Stevie and then Stevie co-wrote some songs, but the majority of them were George and Harry's. And they produced them. So they produced, wrote, and in most cases played the instruments on a lot of the recordings. Then they signed AC/DC with George's two younger brothers, you know. They love rock music, and these two guys, with, you know, their guitar playing was exceptional. So they signed AC/DC, and it took a while to find the right lineup for them. They had quite a few different members in the early days, but when they found the right unit, they were unstoppable. They knew exactly where they wanted to go. Malcolm was the, you know, the backbone of the band, and he had a vision and it was going to the world, and Angus had the showmanship to take it wherever Malcolm thought it would go. They just knew what they were going to do. Then the Rose Tattoo came to the stable. We had the Angels, totally different band again, but great rock songs, great rock music. Again, George and Harry involved. The Choir Boys, Flash in the Pan. I mean, we're talking, all those albums came out of the one, you know, label and all came out within a period of 5 years or so. And those artists, but there's like 3 to 4 albums on most of those artists. That's a huge amount of product to come out of one small label.
How did your job change, FIFA, as Albert's became a hit factory?
I think I was the constant behind the scenes because we had various different A&R managers over the years and everyone contributed quite a bit. I was more involved in the early days. I was more involved with doing, you know, organising photography, video shoots, biographies, doing artwork, more or less piecing everything together once something was recorded, and also working alongside in promotions and marketing and touring. So I just little by little went from being secretary to working in promotions to being in the label, being A&R, and then general manager. So it was like all those things just kept moving along with me. Everything just kept growing a little bit more. I didn't leave anything behind when I went to the next step. You know, that seemed to grow with me because we're a very small company. So there was like basically George, Harry and myself and then one assistant. There might have been 7 of us in total. And we just worked so well together. My involvement was that I knew the bands really well. I saw all of our bands, wherever they were all the time. I knew what was going on. I knew every jock in Australia that had anything to do with rock. I knew all the television compares, everything that was going on. I had a great network. And so that was my strength. But, you know, it only came from the fact that I had so much confidence in George and Harry and in the bands that we signed, that they had such strong work ethics that I could never do any less than what they were doing. And we all got on really well together as a team.
Tell me, FIFA, about the first AC/DC gig you went to in 1974 in the glamorous environs of Rockdale in Sydney.
Yeah, it was when Bon had come up with the guys and was doing a gig at the Masonic Hall. And I had gone to see them because George and Harry, they said, you know, maybe you want to pop in and see them, see what you think of Bon. And I thought, yeah, okay, I'll pop in. And I did. And the place was crowded and it was really rocking. And Bon was screaming and shouting from the top of his lungs. And he was like really crass and really loud. And I thought, quite vulgar, which is a strange way to describe a band because most rock bands were a touch of all of that. But I thought everything about him that says, I'm in this band, I am the singer of this band, and it was true. He just fitted in perfectly. And I cringed a little bit because he did do a lot of swearing and I just wasn't used to it. So at the end of the show, everybody, you know, roared. It went over extremely well. And I was about to leave. And the manager said, you know, you're going to come back and see him. And I hadn't intended to. I thought, I've seen him. I'll just tell George and Harry what I think. And I went back. And it just changed completely. Just changed completely. When I went back, he was so charming. He was so polite. He was so attentive. He was everything. He was so wonderful. And I'm thinking, that can't be the same guy I just saw up there. He picked up my hand. He kissed my hand. Well, he must have done. I'm sure he did that with every female he was with. And I thought he was wonderful. And I went back and I told George and Harry the next day, you know, I said, he's loud, he's crass, he's vulgar, he swears, and he fits perfectly. He fits perfectly, and he did. And that was the beginning of another long friendship, you know, with someone who I would never have picked, really, but I thought the world of.
I can remember seeing AC/DC make their first appearance on Countdown. I must have been only 9 years old, FIFA. I remember them performing Baby Please Don't Go with Bon, yes, dressed in a school dress,
like a little girl,
Angus's schoolgirl dress. And you can see the band is trying to smother their laughter at Bond's antics. And I remember at nine thinking that was the baddest thing I'd ever seen on TV, and it was utterly thrilling. And looking back at that film clip now, it just sounds like an avalanche. It's so exciting. Did you get that sense of their electricity, that AC/DC, their kind of power, the rumbling power of the band?
Oh, without question. Without question. I mean, I used to just, as soon as that first note was hit, didn't matter what song it was, you know, as soon as they hit that first note, you knew, you know, you were going to go somewhere. They were going to transport you somewhere, and they never failed to do so.
The fact that you all came from migrant families, I mean, the guys in AC/DC, most of them were the children, they were Scottish migrants themselves who'd come out when they were kids. Harry Vander was from a Dutch family who migrated when he was mm-hmm. a kid. You're a migrant. Was that meaningful? Did you connect at that level, do you think?
I think what happened, without really knowing it, I always felt like the Albert family was my family. And I think the reason that it was like that was that it was unspoken, but none of us had any issues with anyone being anything. If you weren't Australian, you know, in the outside world, I was considered a wog for so many years and a dago, and it was just really, really demoralizing. But at Albert's, I mean, we had a Maltese tea lady who was just gorgeous, and she had her children work there as well. So we had Maltese, we had a Greek caretaker, such a mixture. But music seems to, this is such a cliche, I know, but it has no boundaries. And everybody, you never said someone was a great German guitarist. You said he was a great guitarist. And you recognise them for what they did, and anything else was, you know, you didn't see. And there was never any of that racism that was still very evident in the 60s, let me tell you, and early 70s. There was none of that at Albert's, none of that at all. Ted was so compassionate. He was so talented. He was visionary. He was a pioneer. He experimented. He loved the differences in people. All of those things he encouraged. I mean, he encouraged me from day one. He was the one that gave me every opportunity. And if I couldn't see it, he had taught me into it. You know, he was the one that pushed me forward.
I've seen photos of you with Malcolm Young and with Bon, and they're hanging on your shoulder, like in a very sisterly, brotherly way. Is that what you were to them in a way, or a den mother, apart from being a manager, you're giving off major big sister vibes, I suppose. That's what I'm saying in those photos. Is that how it worked, FIFA, to some degree?
Well, I think that's probably exactly the way it was. And it was I never managed them, but I mean, I had their back for everything, for all the bands, and I always felt the same way about them. And I think that Malcolm would have had my back all the time if anything came up, and Bon, without question. And I really, to this day, I still, you know, consider John Paul Young still one of my dearest friends, and angry. And it's just, you know, something that's gone on for over 40 years, and it's because we were family. And we all looked out for each other, and I think they always looked out for me. And, you know, I know Bon was supposedly a real hard liver on the outside. You know, he lived his life to the full. But he never did anything in front of me that would ever let me feel that anything like that went on. He knew that I wasn't part of that scene. So if he did anything, it was also always done away from me. But I always felt that they would have protected me if I needed protecting.
He wrote letters to you on the road. Did you do that a lot?
He loved writing. He was a great communicator. He would ring, you know, back in the 70s, it's not like today where you pick up the phone, it might cost you a couple of dollars for a phone call. Back then it cost a lot of money. And he would call me from London and I'd say, "Bon, don't call me because it's too expensive." And he'd say, "Oh, it's all right. I'm in one of the record companies at the moment and I'm in one of their rooms. I've just picked up their telephone." And he used to send me postcards from everywhere. And he'd always like tell me what was going on. He'd always say, you know, "We've just done this gig here and we had all these people turn up." It was never, not from a bragging point of view, but more from, you know, wanting to share with me what they were doing over there. Because I was always wanting to know what was going on, always. They would always be hysterical. His letters, you'd always have one-liners in there. He was a real wordsmith and he loved, you know, sharing that.
We all know the story of how Bon Scott was found dead in a parked car in London in 1980. He was only 33. There's alcohol and maybe heroin involved as well. An awful death for him. Where were you when you found out about his death, FIFA?
I was in Sydney, and when I found out about it, it was George and Harry that told me, and I just found it impossible to believe. I just found it impossible to believe that it had happened. And I'd only spoken to him probably 3 days before, and he just told me that he had been together with Malcolm and Angus. He said he was so excited. He said, "We're going to the studio next week to start work on the album." He said, "I've just heard Malcolm and Angus's riffs." He said, "You can't believe what they're coming up with." He said, "It's going to sound amazing." And he was so up and he was so excited. And they were going into the studio and then this happened. And I'm thinking, no, I just spoke to him. I thought, no, it can't be. And it was. And I found it so hard to accept. But yes, it was true. And he had died from alcoholic poisoning. There was nothing mysterious about it. It was, you know, death by misadventure. And sadly, you know, he was one of those characters that always said, you know, "I'm not here for a long time. I'm here for a good time." And he lived his life to the fullest. And sadly, that's how he went out.
It's sort of seen as inevitable in a way, the rise of AC/DC, even after his death, to become one of the world's biggest bands. But it must have taken a massive act of will to keep the band going after that death and not break up.
Well, the band was devastated. There was no question. And they didn't know whether they would be able to continue. I mean, Bon was bigger than life. They were really big shoes for someone else to have to come in and fill. And it just got, and it was sadly in one way, but in another way, I'm pleased that it happened, was that Highway to Hell had just broken. And so finally started to see the international success. So he got to have a taste of that before he died. But after he passed away, Ted asked me to go to Perth to help the family and to help with getting the funeral together, which I did. And it was heartbreaking. And we buried him in Perth. And one of the most amazing memories that I have, it was so poignant. The gates were open to the cemetery and the hearse was going through and there were five fans on the right-hand side and they had these denim jackets on with RIP Bon on the back of them and they all just put up one arm, one fisted arm and just saluted him as he went past. And it, that was when I realised that he was gone.
That must have left you feeling awfully flat and lost. It sounds like you were very fond of him.
I was very fond of him, and but you know, everyone was. He was that lovable rogue, and it was there that, you know, the band, they were mourning him, and that, you know, they were grieving his loss and not sure what they wanted to do. But Bon's family, mum and dad in particular, had said, you know, Bon would never have wanted them to stop. That wouldn't be what he wanted, you know. And he more than gave them the blessing that he felt that they should continue. And I think that helped them a little bit. I don't think they could ever stop, to be quite honest, because it was in their blood. You know, hearing it from Bon's dad and from Bon's mum that they needed to go on, and that's what they did.
FIFA, you eventually became CEO of Albert Music. You were in that job for 9 years. I'm going to embarrass you now. Your mum and dad must have been so proud of you. You know, having come out of 19 families sharing one room in a house in Abbotsford to becoming this CEO of a culturally hugely important company that's taking Australian music to the world. That's a hell of a thing. Your folks must have been so proud.
Well, my dad passed away, unfortunately, many, many years ago. He died very young. He died when he was 50. But my mum was around, and my mum was extremely pleased. And the reality was, I had a break in between before I left. I left when I'd been there for about 20 years, and I had a couple of years break because I thought I felt burnt out. And Ted had always been so gracious, and he said he never wanted me to have any regrets about anything because I'd given him so many good years. He would never want me to regret being there if I wanted to do something else. So I left, and then he died. He went and died on my birthday. And I just felt that it was like the most an incredible sign that I had to be back there, because I just thought, who's going to look after my label? You know, who's going to look after it? And they did ask me to come back and take over the company. And I came back as general manager, and then several years later, I became CEO. And it was, again, one of those things that was, I just felt very comfortable in doing what I had been doing. It was something that I absolutely treasured the label. I treasured the artist, but, you know, I worked on every one of those songs. I'd gone to radio or television, or, you know, did the artwork for, or arranged photo shoots or video shoots or something. I had an absolute personal connection with every track in some way, and they felt like they were my babies, and someone had to be there to look after them, and it had to be me. So my mum was really pleased that I was back there. And she was really pleased. She was ecstatic when I became CEO, and I was very happy that I could have done that to sort of show her that, you know, maybe it wasn't the wrong move by leaving school when I had. But she was always very encouraging. My mum, there wasn't anything that my mum couldn't do. And you've got to remember, she left school when she was 8. She could run circles around anyone when it came to maths. She had the best handwriting. There wasn't anything that she said she couldn't do. If something was put in front of her, she would find a way of doing it.
It's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Fifa. It's an amazing story, and it's been so enjoyable just following your extraordinary career. Thank you so much, Fifa.
Oh, Richard, thank you very much. It's been lovely talking to you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hi, it's Richard here with a podcast recommendation. If you're keen to get some lively family discussions happening over the dinner table or on long car trips, then this could be the podcast for you and your kids. Short and Curly is a show about life's tricky ethical questions, and hosts Molly and Carl have a new season.
Ho, 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 so, so, so much to do. I've got to fuel the pixie dust tank on the sleigh, polish Rudolph's nose, and stop the elves from unionising.
Santa?
Carl, you've got to hide.
Santa!
Carl, what are you doing? No!
Santa! Santa! It's me, Carl Smith! Remember me? I send you a letter every year!
Carl? What are you doing here? And how did you get past the polar bears?
Oh, well, to be honest, I didn't. They threw me through a wall.
Now wait just one second there, Santa.
Oh, it's you, Molly Daniels.
You know me?
How could I forget the number one name on my naughty list?
A very long list indeed. Short and Curly, the kids' podcast for the whole family. Download it from the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.